So I think that might be why that title, How to Be a Buddhist, is a bit of a tricky one in a way. So I thought I would cheat, or at least make it simpler for myself, by going back to the beginning of Buddhism. How did people define themselves in those days? What did they call it? I mean, actually the word Buddhist, as you probably know, is a recent coinage. It's a European coinage. It's not a traditional word. And if we go back to the very beginning, these were the first Buddhists. Two brothers, Taprusa and Bhālika. Not very well-known people, I think. I predict that probably very, very few people here would have ever heard of them. But they were, traditionally, they are said to be the first Buddhists, if one wants to use that Western term. So after the Buddha had gained enlightenment, after he'd been sitting under the Bodhi tree, he'd been practicing intensively, as you probably know, for 6 years, and then he finally sort of broke through to enlightenment. And then he had a number of experiences after the enlightenment, which included the arrival of the monsoon, when, according to the legend, a giant cobra appeared and reared over his head, and with its hood, you know, cobras have this sort of big hood behind their head, sheltered him from the rain under what was known as the Muchalinda tree as he was meditating. And then he moved on from there, and it was then, the next episode in his experience, is him meeting these two brothers. And they were merchants, and we don't know very much about them, but I assume they were coming along with a couple of pack horses, carrying their goods along through the countryside, past the grove where the Buddha was meditating, in order to sell their goods at the next town. But they were obviously very struck by him when they saw him sitting there under the tree, and they went up to him. And the two of them, for a while, as far as I can gather, they just sort of sat there, and the Buddha sat there as well. He didn't feel the need at that stage to say anything, really. He hadn't quite got used to talking again after such a long time of meditating. And he sat there, and eventually one of the brothers said to him, would you like some flapjack? And he said, actually, I'm a bit peckish. I would like some flapjack. So they opened their saddlebags and they got out this honey-based flapjack and they gave it to him. And so they all shared a meal. You know, in a way, that's a lovely thing to do, isn't it? You imagine the three of them sitting there in the countryside, a lull from the monsoon rain, and they're just sharing some food together. And then they chat, and the conversation is not recorded. We don't know what happens. But they became Buddhists, the two of them. They decided, we are going to become your disciples. We really like you. We think you're a great guru, you're a great teacher. And then off they go. They go back home. They came from the Orissa region. And we don't hear all that much more about them. But they did become Buddhists, and they practiced, and the legend says they gained enlightenment. And he gave them a memento. They said, could we have something to remember you by? So he gave each of them a lock of his hair, which they took away. And that hair still exists. Although, unfortunately, we don't know exactly where it is, because there's a stupa in Afghanistan which claims it. Sorry, two stupas in Afghanistan that claim it. The Temple of the Tooth in Kandy in Sri Lanka claims it, as does one of the big temples in Burma. So they all say they've got this lock of hair, or these two locks of hair from the Buddha, so who knows? It's all legendary stuff, really, isn't it? Anyway, that was their names. Taprusa and Bhālika. And they said, you know, they said the usual thing, which is probably like a later edition, isn't it? But they said the usual thing that people said when they became Buddhists during the Buddha's lifetime, which was, we go for refuge to the Buddha. We go for refuge to the Dharma. But they stopped there because there wasn't a Sangha. There was no Sangha at the time. And this may be why they don't sort of turn up very much. Because they, in a way, I think this is rather a crucial thing about getting involved with Buddhism. Is there a Sangha for you or not? For them, there wasn't. They had the Buddha, they'd met him. They had some teachings, presumably. Maybe he taught them some meditation practices to take away. But what they didn't have was a network of people, a sort of supportive network of people who could encourage them, who could mentor them, who could help them to learn how to practice Buddhism and give them support, mutual support and so on. And I think if you do have that, for most people it makes a difference. I think there probably are some people who are actually fine by themselves. I don't want to exaggerate about this. Some people who can just get on with it, maybe even from a book. you know, and make huge progress. I've met people like that who've been meditating for years, and they picked it up just from a book, and they've really have made genuine progress. But sooner or later, I think most people need the third of the three refuges, not just to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, but the third one, which we were reciting before the meditation, to the Sangha for refuge I go, to the spiritual community for refuge I go. And so that's what developed over the next few months of the Buddha's life. He got together, as you probably know, with five former colleagues, and he developed the Dharma through conversation with them. And then the next one he met was a young man called Yasa, who ran away. There's a lovely story. I haven't got time to go into the whole of it, but he ran away from a party. He was having a birthday party, and he got so horrified when he woke up and looked at the debris of the party. It was a very wild party. Everyone else was asleep, you know, and there was sandwiches that had got stuffed behind the sofa and all that kind of thing. You know, there was salad dressing that had been trodden into the carpet, and somebody had vomited. Yeah, I won't get into detail, but he literally rushed out of the party, saying, "This is dreadful. This is horrible. This is dreadful. This is horrible. This is dreadful. This is horrible." And it's a very comical image of him hairing off down the street at 5 o'clock in the morning in the dark. And he goes out of the town where he's living, and he goes into this forest area. And by complete coincidence, that is where the Buddha was staying. And the Buddha was doing walking meditation at the time, just doing walking meditation up and down. And he stopped his walking, and he said to Yasa, was still saying, "It's terrible, it's horrible, it's disgusting." And the Buddha stood there, and he looked around him. And it's just a beautiful, imagine a beautiful night, the stars shining down onto the trees, maybe deer grazing in the distance, you know, the trickle of water. And the Buddha said, "This isn't disgusting, this is not horrible, this is really nice." And Yasa sort of came to himself and looked around, and, "Oh, it is, isn't it? Yeah." And, of course, then there was a conversation. The Buddha, like with the two merchants, Tapusa and Balika, the Buddha and Yasa had a conversation. They had a chat. And Yasa thought, "This is for me. This is for me. I'm going to be a Buddhist. I'm going to be a Buddhist." So that was the first person maybe to define themselves in terms of the Sangha as well, because there was already that small group of people who gathered around the Buddha. And a bit later on, of course, his dad turns up, because his father, when daylight comes, realizes that his son has vanished. And he looks at them. First of all, he's very annoyed about the mess that the kids have left. Yes, he's about 18 maybe at the time. And then he gets more and more worried. And he and his wife both are really worried what's happened to Yasa. He's just vanished completely. And he sends out search parties. And it's his father himself who finds him in the forest there. And his father has a conversation with the Buddha. And his father says, "I like this. That seems good stuff, this Buddhism business. Yeah, I like this. Let's have a go at it." So he becomes a Buddhist. And then what then happens is that Yasa and his father invite the Buddha and his five friends back for a meal. So they all turn up. By this time, probably mainly the women of the house, as usual, have cleared up the mess. And so they can have a bit of a meal, an evening meal together. So they have the evening meal, or maybe it's midday meal, I'm not quite sure. And they all sit around. And this time, the Buddha is sitting next to Yasa's wife, and they have a conversation. And Yasa's wife thinks, "I like this Buddhism business. I think I'll become a Buddhist as well." And so this is the way it sort of starts. It starts very much through word of mouth. And many of the earliest disciples are amongst Yasa and his family's friends in this particular town. It all becomes a bit of a craze, and quite a lot. Some of them decide to leave their homes and become monks. Others stay at home and practice in a household manner. So that's how things begin with those very early disciples. In each case, their decision to become a Buddhist is marked by them saying, "I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dharma. I go for refuge to the Sangha." And to this day, that is what is recited in probably just about every Buddhist country in some language or another, as a way of sort of marking the solidarity of being Buddhists together, to recite those refuges and then recite the precepts, the guidelines, the ethical guidelines to do with your life that you're trying to follow. I thought I'd mention one other little story from the early days of the Buddha, which I don't know why I thought of mentioning this, but I find it a very touching story. This is the story of Patachara. I don't know if anyone's heard of her. So she was faced by an intense tragedy. Her whole family died in a very short space of time, in very tragic circumstances, including her two young children, her husband, and both her parents. And she was so traumatized by this experience that she basically went mad. And she was just wandering around, staring-eyed, not covering herself properly, which was disgraceful in those times in India. So she wasn't dressed properly, and people were sort of keeping out of her way and rather scared of her. And she wandered in at the back of a lecture that the Buddha was giving. And the people said, "Don't go away, you know, this is an important spiritual teacher here, you know, just go somewhere else, couldn't you?" But of course the Buddha spotted her, and he stopped giving his lecture and he went up to her. And according to the story, he just said to Patachara, he said, "Sister, regain your mindfulness." He just said that to her, "Sister, regain your mindfulness." And she sort of came to herself. I don't know how to describe it really, but something happened as a result of that communication whereby she realized, you know, that, I don't know, that there was still, it was still worth living, I suppose. It was still worth living. And in fact, she did the same thing. She went for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. She became a disciple of the Buddha, and she became a very important teacher. A number of her disciples are recorded. She became a great speaker, one of the great speakers on Buddhism. And then another example of people becoming Buddhists in the early days, which I found interesting, was a whole group of people, the Kalamas. And I thought this is also interesting because the whole thing starts here when the Buddha, who used to wander around, he turned up in their village, a village called Kesaputta, belonging to this, I don't know, guild or tribe called the Kalamas. And they went up to him and they said, "We'd like you to give us a bit of advice." Or even, I'm not quite sure, this may have been actually a bit of a challenge to them. You know, come on, you know, what are you up to? Because they said, "Look, we're always getting people like you turning up here. People follow different religions. And they say, we've got the truth. We know what's right. You know, we know what is true." And they revile. And he says, they pluck. And the word used is when you take a chicken and pluck all the feathers out. That is what they do to other people's teaching. So what can we do about it? You know, they're all saying they're right and everyone else is wrong. And so the Buddha gives them this piece of advice, I suppose you could call it. Not saying, "No, I've got it. You know, I'm the right one. You should follow me. All the others are rubbish." What instead he says, he gives them some suggestions as to how they can distinguish between helpful and unhelpful teachings. Now, this is quite a well-known text. I'm sure you've heard it before, but I'll just read it out for you because I find it very interesting. So the Kalamas said, "Bante," which is what they call him, "certain spiritual aspirants and priests visit Kesaputta. They only explain and illuminate their own teachings, and they condemn, abuse, and pull to pieces the teachings of others. Then different teachers come and visit, and they do exactly the same thing. We're in doubt and uncertainty about them, Bante. Which of them tells us the truth, and which of them is speaking falsely?" So it's very reasonable question to ask, really, I think. And so what the Buddha says, he says, "You're definitely right to be in doubt and uncertainty about this." That's quite an affirming thing to start off by saying, isn't it? And he says, "It is a doubtful matter." He says, "What I'm going to suggest to you is, don't rely on what you hear repeatedly." He gives this list of what he says is not a reliable way to tell whether it's a useful teaching or not. "Don't rely on what you hear repeatedly, nor on what is handed down in a tradition or a lineage, nor on hearsay, nor on a scripture as authority, nor on sophistry or logical inference." You know, it may sound very logical. "Nor on prolonged consideration, nor on getting carried away by a view that you personally identify with, nor on indulgence in the pleasure of speculating, nor on somebody making a plausible impression on you, nor on something that, nor on your respect for a spiritual teacher." So this is, maybe I'll write this list down, because it's a very interesting list, it seems to me. And you think, what is left? And if you can't rely on any of these things, what are you going to do? So I'll just write it in shorthand. So first of all, what you hear repeatedly. So I think this, we get this sometimes, don't we? You know, you hear it so much. It's every day on the radio, it says the same thing. We were talking about, I'm talking to somebody about Ed Miliband today. And she is a real fan of Ed Miliband. And she gave some very good reasons for thinking he's a great guy, you know. And I don't know if she's right or wrong. But it just occurred to me that very quite subtly, at least in my experience, the press and even the BBC are gradually sort of ridiculing him a bit, you know. And in a way, because you hear it so often, you start to think, yeah, probably he's not really up to much, is he, you know, because you hear it so often. I don't know whether he is or not, but just hearing something repeatedly is not enough. The next one is tradition. So some people say, well, it's traditional, you know, we've been taught for ages, you know, it's been handed down from time immemorial when people really were wise. He said, no, that's not enough. Hearsay. Scripture. That's not reliable. Just because it's written, you know, some people will use that, won't they? It's in the Quran. Look, here it says it here, or it's in the Bible, or even it's in the Pali Canon. It must be true. The Buddha said, so it must be true. And then there's, let's just say, logic. It's an interesting one, because some people would say logic is always reliable, but it depends on what assumptions you start with, doesn't it, as to whether you can rely on logic. It might be that the sequence of steps that you take is very good, but what assumptions are you starting with? And sometimes we take those assumptions for granted, and we think, well, I've arrived at this by a very logical process, so it must be right. Prolonged consideration. In other words, the fact I've been thinking about this for ages, and this is the conclusion I come to. So I've put so much energy into it, I must have got it right by now. Identification. So getting carried away by a view you identify with. So it's like a personal thing there, isn't it? It's as if it's like part of your, maybe it's what your parents have said or something like that. It's something that you feel an allegiance to for a personal reason. And you may get carried away with that view. Speculation. And it actually says that the indulgence in the pleasure of speculation. I'm sure you can think of examples of that, you know, where one comes up with completely speculative ideas, and you, in a way, you convince yourself that you've come to the right conclusion. Plausible impression. Because some people, they do seem very convincing, don't they? You look at those debates on the television, you know, you look for the different politicians, and maybe one of them, yeah, they've got a ring to them, haven't they? They seem very convincing, yeah. So they've made a plausible impression. Respect for a guru. Respect for a spiritual teacher. Even that. It's a very interesting list, isn't it, I think. So what does the Buddha say? What is reliable? And basically what he says, well, I'll read it out. He says, Kalamas, when you know of yourselves that these teachings are unskillful, blamable, faulted by sensible people, and that followed through in practice, they lead to harm and dukkha, or suffering, then give them up. But, Kalamas, when you know of yourselves that these teachings are skillful, blameless, they're recommended by sensible people, and that followed through in practice, they lead to welfare and happiness, then practice them and stick to them. So in a way, it's maybe a bit disappointing, really, to say something sort of so obvious. But it's also quite encouraging, isn't it, in a way, isn't it? It's, in a way, he is saying, you know, your experience is helpful. You don't just need to rely on your experience. You probably know some people that you already trust, some sensible people. So talk it over with them as well, so you're not just relying on your own judgment. And it's not just a matter of judgment, either. It's to do with seeing what the effects are. Do they lead to problems, or do they lead to benefit? And in the end, that is the criteria for it. And so that's what he suggests. And then that is how the Kalamas decide, yeah, we like that approach. And they become... He gives them some more teachings. It's very interesting. I suggest you read the whole thing. He teaches them the Metta Bhavana, is what he does next. And he talks about the value of metta, and he talks about the value of skillful states of mind and so on. And he makes some suggestions as to what kind of meditation and what kind of mental work that they can do. And he just asks them, what do you think? You think if you did this, would it tend to lead to your benefit or not? Is it worth giving it a go? And they say, yeah, sounds good. Yeah, I think I'll try that, yeah. So in a way, that's what makes them Buddhists. What makes them Buddhists is simply wanting to try out the suggestions for practice that the Buddha is making. And I suppose that I think that's probably the case nowadays for most people. That's what makes them, maybe they don't call themselves Buddhists, but makes them somebody who is making use of the Buddhist path. It's just that they think, yeah, I think this is worth trying. This is worth trying. These practices are worth giving a go. And it doesn't mean signing your name in blood or even defining yourself in some way if you don't want to. It seems to me that those teachings, those practices are available. They're not exclusive. You don't have to sign up. You can just make use of them. And one hopes that some of them will be beneficial. So in other words, this is particularly advice that he gives to Kalamas on leading a life that is fulfilling, leading a life that leads in general to happiness, but also that it leads to a better world for others as well. That sense of the importance of compassion and love is very strongly in this sutta. The Buddha's saying it's important not just that it's good for you, but it's good for others as well, what you're doing for other people. But there may be something else involved in people becoming Buddhist. And here I want to go back to another sort of autobiographical text where the Buddha gives an account of the process he's gone through. And I find this one extremely interesting as well, the way he explains it. Because what he talks about is, he says, look, I realised when I was a young man, I was subject to a lot of problems in my life. You know, I could see I was getting problems of depression, I was getting problems of losing what I liked, I was getting problems of seeing illness and death and old age as being prospects in my life, and sickness and so on. I was getting problems of longing, of not having what I felt I needed. But I would go, I would find things that I thought might solve those problems. But I realised those things I found were subject to exactly the same difficulties. They were also subject to ageing and death and dissolution and sickness and decay and longing and so on. The people I went to, you know, because he married for love, and, you know, his wife, his son, his baby, his parents, his possessions, his palaces. And he talks in this sutra about, you know, your possessions, your land, your horses, all that kind of thing, saying, thinking maybe these will be the answer, maybe these will solve these problems. But then he said he'd gradually realize all these things he was going to solve his difficulties were themselves subject to the same difficulties. And so then he said, I want to look for something different. And that's what made him go out on his quest. He calls it the Noble Quest. It's called the Sutra of the Noble Quest, this one, if you want to look it up. So he says, I wanted to look for something that was not subject to death, was not subject to sickness and so on, and which represented liberation. He calls it the liberation from the bonds. I wanted to seek what was liberated from the bonds. Because he'd seen the drawbacks in what he had previously been going to for security. So in a way, this is another step beyond the good life that he's suggesting to the Kalamas. It's actually something to do with going into the unknown, I suppose, taking a step into the unknown and looking for a refuge, as it were, in, you know, the deathless. And this word, the deathless, which also is a shorthand for that which is not filled with sorrow, not filled with longing, and not filled with sickness and so on. That, in a way, is what awakening or enlightenment was characterized as in the early Buddhist texts. The deathless. Amata is the word, amata. The deathless. Quite a beautiful word. And so, again, this is something that he can recommend to others. You know, maybe you can go on this quest as well. And maybe we can go on it together. You know, we can start looking. Maybe we won't find it. Maybe when we find it, we won't recognize it. Maybe if we do recognize it, we'll then realize, no, it's limited. But you have that sort of moving into the open, moving into the unknown, as being, in a way of characterizing being a Buddhist. So I wanted to move a bit more up to date now. Well, in fact, this is still very traditional, but this is inspired by this book here, which I very strongly recommend if you haven't read it, which is called What Makes You Not a Buddhist? And it's by Dzongtsa Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, who is a Tibetan teacher, so-called incarnate lama, so sort of quite a prestigious teacher, but also a filmmaker. He made a film called The Cup, which was about Tibetan monks getting obsessed with football during the World Cup. He made a biographical film about Milarepa. He's made a number of films, very good films. And he also wrote this book. And what he suggests here, and I'm not saying he's necessarily right, but I find it extremely interesting what he says. He basically says that a lot of people think they get into Buddhism because they discover something about Buddhism that really does appeal to them. For example, they discover mindfulness meditation, and it's really helpful, genuinely helpful. They discover maybe the emphasis on love and compassion, and they think that's and being nice to people, and they think, well, that is great, you know, they like that. They discover the sense of seeking peace of mind and tranquility. But what he says is that's not Buddhism. You know, these may be great. There's nothing wrong with these things. They are definitely effects of meditating and effects maybe of practicing Buddhism. But that is not deeply what it's about. And what it's deeply about is the four seals. The seals, not as in creatures that swim in the ocean, but sort of seals in the sense of, you know, like the old Elizabethan letters with a big lump of melted wax. And you put your seal on it, don't you? So that's sort of, so they're known as the four seals. And this is very traditional Buddhist teaching. He puts it in his own way, and I'll put his way in my own way slightly. What he points out, he says, these are not very appealing, the four seals. Because being nice to everybody, love and so on, this is very appealing, almost. Being calm and tranquil and mindful, this is all very nice. But these are a little bit challenging. I'm sure you'll come across them before, if you've had any contact with Buddhism before. The first one is everything in life is flowing and changing. So it's the reality of change. Nothing is immune to change. Which, in one sense, is a bit disappointing, because whatever you value, you will lose. You can't keep anything. You can't hang on to anything. But in another sense, it's very, very... it's great relief to think that actually, at least we're not stuck with things as they are. You know, whatever situation you're in, it is going to change, and let's ride that change. Let's make it a sailing into, you know, new oceans, into something more exciting, more alive than it is now, more awake than it is now. So awakening is possible because of change. The second one is expectations and assumptions. And needs lead to pain. The way he actually puts it, I'll write this down because he puts it in a very challenging way, which sort of justifies, but it's a little bit challenging. Basically, he says all emotions are pain. Of course, he means something very specific by emotion, so I've translated it a bit by saying that all one's expectations, one's assumptions, and one's needs will tend to lead to pain. And then the third one is nothing is separate. And no one is separate. So far you may have recognised these as what are called the three lakshanas, the three marks. Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality. Nothing is separate. So nothing is self-existent is a sort of philosophical term. Nothing can just be there without being affected by other things. Which is very closely connected. That's why everything changes, yeah, because nothing is isolated. Yeah, nothing is really solid. I suppose you could say, and that doesn't just refer to atoms and molecules and galaxies and the physical universe. It also refers to our own moods, our own states of mind, our own relationships, our own bodies, and everything. And then the fourth seal is the way I paraphrase it is rather long. But it's possible to dwell in a pure awake awareness that can't be conveyed using concepts. I'll write this as short as awakening is not conceptual. In other words, you can't, in a way, get to being fully aware, fully present, fully awake, just by understanding things. Which, of course, means that nobody can say something to you that will make you awake. And you think, oh, that's it. That's the answer, right? I've got it. I'll jot that down in my notebook. I've got it all worked out now. Fantastic. Yeah. Nothing you put in words can sum up awakening or enlightenment. So those are the four seals. And what he basically says is, he says that you need to take these on board. If you want to be a proper Buddhist, at least from his point of view, I'm not saying I fully agree with this, but I think it's very interesting and very challenging what he says, then you need to be prepared to take these on board and in a way live from them and see what implications they have for you. If they're true, you sort of apply them as lenses to the different aspects of your life and your behaviour. What does that imply for me? Are there places where I'm assuming that things won't change? Are there places that I assume that there are particular states of mind or beliefs or something that are really going to give me ultimate satisfaction, are going to be the answer? Because he said no, there aren't any. Am I assuming that I myself am completely autonomous? You know, I'm a real being. Am I assuming that other people are separate from me? Am I assuming that the universe is running separately from me? And then finally, do I, underneath, and I think this is one of my things, I think if I read enough, eventually I'll find the answer. It must be one of these books somewhere. If only I could jot down the connections and write an index and get it all, I'll get it, you know. Sometimes I can't even turn the radio off because I think, it might be coming up, you know. It might be in the next programme. There's going to be, the penny will drop. That is what it is. That's what's really going on, you know. Please say no. It's not. It's not conceptual. It's direct experience. That's what it is. So I've given you a few, I hope, a few clues as to what's involved in a way of becoming a Buddhist by giving you some of these historical examples. In a way, the two merchants who were responding to the enormous presence and charisma of the Buddha and decided that he was their teacher. And for some people, it might be that sense of finding a teacher, finding a guru, which is really the answer. And then we saw, in the case of Yasa and his family, the creation of Sangha. We saw the creation of spiritual community is just as important as finding a teacher or finding a path, finding practices that help you. You need the third jewel as well, the Sangha jewel. On the cases, you probably know the yellow one, the golden one, is the Buddha jewel. The blue one for blue skies, is the Dharma jewel, the path. And the red one, the red of love, is the Sangha jewel. And then I mentioned the Kalamas. So you have that sense of this community of people being totally confused as to what teachings are really helpful and what are not, and being given some very useful, I think, suggestions by the Buddha as to how to, or what you can't rely on, what you shouldn't go to, which even includes a guru. So, you know, those merchants, the Buddha would have said, it's just because I'm charismatic, just because it doesn't mean that I've got it, you know. Don't feel that just your respect for a teacher is enough, he's saying to the Kalamas. And instead, he gives them some specific advice about relying on their own experience and relying on their mentors, people, sensible people that they know, what they would say, and then actually seeing what the effect is. What's the effect of trying these things? Do they work or not? Do they make a difference or not? And then I gave the example of the Noble Quest, the Buddha's own decision, where he realized that he'd been putting his trust in just the usual stuff, that family life would bring the ultimate satisfaction, or that learning things would bring the ultimate satisfaction, or possessions, or status, all these things would bring satisfaction. And he realized that all those things that he was seeking satisfaction from were themselves lacking in satisfaction. They themselves didn't have the deathless, the sorrowless that he was seeking. And so he needed to sort of to look further and to look for this non-conceptual awakening, if you like, or at least to be open to it, let's say, rather than look for it, just to be open to it happening. So we have all these suggestions. So what about for us? And it seems to me that I find all of these processes quite relevant, and maybe at different times, different ones are most relevant for me. Maybe the thing that inspires me the most, in a way, is that noble quest, is that sense of trying to be open to the unknown, trying to be open to what cannot be summed up, you know, being it not just when meditating, but at all times, to realize that the depths of mystery in just getting to know that another human being is absolutely incredible. And not thinking that I understand them, not thinking, I know you now, right, good, got you sorted out. You never get anyone's self, do you? There's always more to them than that. So that noble quest of being open to the unknown, of looking for the deathless. I'm not going to say anything about what that word deathless might mean, but it sort of is rather evocative somehow, isn't it? It obviously doesn't mean living forever. The Buddha just lived a normal, well, he lived to be 80, quite a good span of life for those days, but he never pretended he wasn't going to die. He was always reminding people he was going to die, you know, saying there's no point getting attached to me, mate, I'm going to die. So that thing, you know, how does one enact this shift? Now, I think there are a lot of ways of doing it, and, you know, in a way, if you learn about Buddhism, you'll learn techniques, you'll learn methods, you'll learn the path and so on. But in particular, I think there is this issue of whether or not you have a Sangha. There are some people, like the two merchants, who had no choice, like other people, maybe who can go it alone. But I think for most of us, we need a Sangha. And I think that's probably the only reason for developing an allegiance to a particular Buddhist tradition or a particular Buddhist centre. There's no real intrinsic reason for doing that apart from the value of having a Sangha. Now, you could have a very broad Sangha. You could sort of have the sense of, well, you know, some people will say this, you know, I'm always meeting spiritual people that I learn from. I sit at the foot of this teacher, and then I go to this teacher, and I chat to these people. It's all valuable. And maybe that is okay to some extent. But I have a sense that there's something else one can derive from a Sangha, which is itself in one stream of tradition, where there are common practices that one's trying out together, in a way. There's a common approach, a common systematic approach to the Dharma. That doesn't mean it's right, as opposed to wrong. It doesn't mean it's better. It just means that, for now at least, one has decided that this particular stream of Dharma is one that I'm going to try to benefit from, and I'm going to try to drink from, if you like. I'm going to try to drink from that stream for a while. So, nowadays, you'll get many, many possible Buddhist traditions that you can get involved in. In the traditional Buddhist countries, you've got a particular big choice to make. I was just talking about this earlier today with Nick. How you'll have, in a way, the choice, do I become a monk or nun, or do I not become a monk or nun? It's a definite choice you've got to make. The majority of people won't want to do it because it's such a major commitment. But to some extent, that's seen as being a bit second best. That because you haven't given up family life, the possibility of family life, and given up the possibility of possessions and all that kind of thing, it means that you're not really a proper Buddhist. But that really hasn't taken root very strongly in Western countries, and it's even in decline in many Buddhist countries. In fact, say in Japan, it declined a very long time ago, and they've got a very different system there. So in Western countries, you'll tend to get people who are serious Buddhist practitioners without necessarily being monks or nuns. Some may be, some may not be. But they are serious Buddhist practitioners. So if you're making the decision in a traditional culture, you may have that dilemma. But I don't think we do have that dilemma particularly. You know, the option is there if somebody wants to, but it's not that you can only be really seriously practicing if you're a monk or a nun. So we ourselves, practicing to some extent in a Western country, we've got before us these three jewels, you know, the three most precious things according to Buddhism. We've got the Buddha, and the Buddha doesn't mean, in this context, the man who founded Buddhism 2,500 years ago. What it really means is a valuing of being more awake, the valuing of being more awake, feeling that that is something really precious, to be more aware, to be more present. Never to be satisfied, in a way, with the degree of awareness of self and other that you've developed. And all is feeling, the Buddha jewel means wanting more of it, going for more of it. And then the Dharma, which means not just, in a way, having that aspiration, but trying to find ways of putting it into practice. Okay, I'd like to be more awake, I'd like to be more aware. What does that imply? I need to learn things, I need to meditate maybe, I need to practice mindfulness and so on. I need to actually put those things into practice. Yeah. And that's the Dharma jewel. Finding preferably maybe a systematic approach to practice where you can discover what's the best thing to be working on now. What's my next step now? And that's where the Sangha jewel comes in, because the Sangha jewel is a network of people that are helping in this process. And so with any luck, you can not just have to make the decision by yourself, but as with the Kalamas, you can also have the involvement of sensible people. Not necessarily enlightened people, but people who have some experience, who've tried it out, and they might say, well, have you tried this? Or maybe the reason your metta is such a struggle at the moment, your metta bhavana is such a struggle, is because of this, you know, and try doing it this way. You know. So to have those, that a bit of advice is really helpful. But I don't think that exhausts the value of Sangha. The value of Sangha is also the fact that we ourselves need, and nearly all of us at least, need connection. Connection is one of the basic human needs, to have a connection with other people that are prepared to take us seriously and to understand us. And I'm sure we have that amongst our friends and family and so on. But if you can find a grouping of people where that is in a way encouraged and taken for granted, that's fantastic. People really taking you seriously and making those personal connections, strong, loving personal connections with people through that. So I feel that, in a way, becoming a Buddhist is not to do with adopting a set of beliefs, not even necessarily the four seals. These are not important as beliefs. These are important as, I suppose, things to take, approaches to life that are worth taking seriously. But they're always provisional anyway. You know, you don't know if they're true or not. It's to do with priorities. It's to do with prioritizing things in your life rather than adopting beliefs. And this is something that a number of the other speakers in this series were all saying, I think. Priorities in the way you live, in the way you behave, and also priorities in where your mind is going, the way your mind is attending. And so I think this is where joining comes in. It's to do with finding a sangha, I think. And there are many sanghas. There are many types of Buddhists. There are traditional sanghas. I thought of going through some of them. Maybe I will very briefly. We've got some time. But I'm not really an expert at all on all the different Buddhist sanghas. This Tri Ratna is the only one I myself have been fully committed to. I've been on retreats, I've been to lectures, I've had friends who are involved in other sanghas, and particularly it's through friends that I've started to get a sense of the way that they practice. For example, one of them is an organisation called the Diamond Way, which is a Tibetan Buddhist organisation founded by a Danish teacher called Ole Nudal. And there's a very strong sense of, you know, the enlightened teacher in that, and very, very energetic, very vigorous way of practicing, based in Tibetan Buddhism, but also updated. Another one where I've got some very close friends involved, and also where I've been on retreats, is the Community of Interbeing, which was founded by a Vietnamese Zen teacher called Thich Nhat Hanh, who is still alive, although rather ill at the moment, who is based in France. And there you have something with a very strong Zen and also a very strong mindfulness approach from the Theravada, and a very gentle, humorous approach to the Dharma. Very, very, very attractive. Another one that I thought of, which I know less about, but it just struck me that one of the people that used to come regularly here on Tuesdays, he had two allegiances. He would go every week down to the Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square to their Zen group. And there, they would be very, very, very strictly ritualized. They wouldn't talk to each other. They would simply go through the Zen rituals of bowing, of dressing and sitting in a particular way, of doing shekintaza practice, which means just sitting, and maybe listening to a sutra or something like that. And then they would go away, and they had no contact outside that. But he found that really helpful, to have that for the austere side of his Buddhism, I suppose, and have this for the more fun and sort of togetherness side of Buddhism. You know. And then another friend I had who I met on a flight, we were both coming back from Dublin, and she was a follower of Soka Gakkai. And Soka Gakkai is a Japanese-based Buddhist movement, where chanting is their main practice. Chanting aloud and in groups is their main practice. And they do a lot of it. And they are very they're very non-monastic, very secular indeed. In fact, they did have a monastic wing, which they broke from in Japan. And so they'll get together in groups in people's houses. They don't particularly go for centres and that kind of thing. And one thing, at first I was a bit suspicious because it seemed so foreign to the kind of Buddhism I was doing. They don't meditate in silence, they just chant. And when they present the chanting, they sometimes present it in a rather materialistic looking way. You know, I chanted because I needed a car or something. Or in the case of Tina Turner, who was a member of this movement, she lost her lipstick. And she chanted and she found it again. And that was what really tipped her into going for it, you know. But I mean, it sounds funny, but I don't mean to disparage them at all, including, I don't disparage Tina Turner, she's a wonderful woman. And they are Buddhist. That is what I realised, talking to my friend who was involved there. And many of the teachers, they sort of keep a little bit quiet about it. But after you've been involved for a while, you discover the six perfections, the three jewels come in, the wheel of life comes in, all the teachings that, or at least many of the teachings we're familiar with, come in. Incidentally, their focus is the White Lotus Sutra, in case you weren't aware of that. So what Jan sees all the... I've just given an example, because there are many others, many, many others. Some of them I'm sure you've had experience of. We were talking with Nick about Goenka and his Vipassana retreats, for example. So some people will feel, yeah, let's just hop around, let's try these different groups. Some people may feel that they're happy to do that for their whole life, in a way to hop around between different groups, try different approaches. That can be good. It can also be driven by restlessness, of course. It may just be that when you reach the barrier of yourself, you actually find, you know, the elements of yourself that are rather stuck. You then blame the tradition that you're following, and you think, well, maybe I'll now try another one. And so that might be a reason for at least sticking with one tradition for a while. So if you do decide to explore one system more thoroughly, I'll just say a little bit more about the system that we're using here in Triratna. Triratna meaning through the three jewels for Buddhism, which accepts, isn't based in one particular Buddhist tradition, but accepts the whole tradition of Buddhism in an ecumenical way, as it's said, but yet tries to do that. It's a very difficult task, actually. Tries to accept the whole of Buddhism, but to do it in a coherent way, not just picking and choosing what one likes. And so I'm an ordained member of the Triratna Buddhist Order, as is Jinananda, and Bodhilila, and Kamalshila, and Vlasmani, yes, and others that you may well have met. So we've decided to make that sort of lifelong commitment, to make the three jewels the centre of our lives, but in this particular context. But not everyone will want to do that. In fact, I think the majority of people won't want to take that step. But I think that's all right. And I'll just finish by saying a little bit about the definition. Where do you join? You know, if you want to join Triratna, what do you do? You can't do it by sending off a membership subscription. It doesn't actually work that way. So what do you do? Now, there is something you can do if you want to do that, which may be a long way in the future for you, but I'll just mention it, which is what's called becoming a mitra. So some of you will be aware of this, but a mitra means a friend. It means you've decided that you want to be a friend of this particular Buddhist order. So you want to make a connection with order members. And if you do, it means that you... I mean, I was going to say you call yourself a Buddhist, but maybe, you know, even as you've heard from this series of talks, even some of the very senior, experienced order members giving this talk, they don't really like the idea of labelling yourself as a Buddhist. And I do very much sympathise with that, I understand. But let's say you're basically happy with the Buddhist approach, let's put it that way, and you're making use of it, you feel that is something for you. You're wanting to associate with members of the order, and you're wanting to help them in what they're doing, like, you know, running a centre like this. And I think that's one of the great things that one can do if you're thinking, how do I be a Buddhist? Just help Buddhism happen, you know, help it to be more available to people that want to come and meditate or to learn, you know, the mindfulness for pain course, say, that Bill is doing on Friday, you know, to come and support that kind of thing, to help out with it. So to come and help. But also, just as important, is in your personal life, is putting the five precepts into practice. What we were chanting before the meditation, really taking that seriously and saying, well, what does that mean for me? What does living a harmless life mean? What does living a truthful life mean for me? And working on that in some way. And having some way in which you're working directly on your mind, I would say, as well. And so what happens if you become a Mitra is that usually the chair of the centre, in this case Paramananda, would perform a ceremony. So during a puja, during a chanting ritual, silence would descend on the whole room, and feeling probably very nervous, you would sort of come forward to the front, and he would hand you, some people here have been through this, they know what it's like, he would hand you first of all a flower, and you wouldn't just take it and say, oh, thank you very much, and go home with it. You would offer it to the Buddha. You put it in a vase in front of the Buddha, and if you wanted to, you'd make a bow. And then he would offer you a candle, and you would light the candle, and you would offer that to the Buddha. And then he would offer you a stick of incense, and you would light that and offer it to the Buddha. So this is very traditional, the three traditional offerings in all, again, all Buddhist schools, very important. The flower for impermanence, the beauty which fades. So a reminder of both the value of beauty and also the fact you can't hold on to it. The candle, the light of awareness. And the incense, which is said to be the fragrance of leading an ethical life. So the fragrance of incense is something that people, if they're around you, if you lead an ethical life, then people know, and they're influenced in a beneficial way by it. So that's the symbolism of those offerings. So it's a very simple ceremony that people undergo if they become a Mitra. Usually on a festival day. So we come full circle in a way. We come back to this act of going for refuge. In the puja, you would also recite the refuges and precepts with everybody else. And in a way, you could say, maybe that's it. You know, are we Buddhist? Are we not? I don't know, really. But we do have something in common, that we respect Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We feel they're valuable, and that we feel it's worth living by the precepts, and we feel it's worth sort of working on ourselves and moving towards being awake. And even sometimes just sitting with each other with a plate of flapjack and sharing food together, just sharing food, sharing. And by that means, by sort of sharing, you know, not just flapjack, but other elements of life, creating a sangha. Okay, I'll leave it there, I think. And there is a bit of time if anyone has any questions.
Can I ask, is nothing is separate, is that the same thing as conditionality?
Yes. Yeah, that's what it comes to. So, yeah. In other words, that whatever things are impermanent, which means they arise, they come into being. But they come into being because of all the other things that have influenced them and made them what they are.
Yeah.
And they themselves become something that influences new things in the future.
Yeah.
And in a sense, there are no things at all.
Yeah.
There are just these strands of connection, these flows in the river of connection, which sometimes we identify as being, you know, a thing. We identify this as being, I'm in a bad mood today. But after a while you realize there's no such thing as that bad mood. There is just a flow of mental states that I've given a particular label to. The label sometimes is helpful, because I think, oh, when I'm in a bad mood, it's good if I go for a walk in the open air. So it's good that you've labeled it. And all of a sudden, it may be unhelpful. You maybe start to brood about it, and you say, I'm always in a bad mood, and it's so-and-so's fault, and if only they didn't do that. And in a way, the label becomes unhelpful. So everything is connected is the same thing as conditionality.
Yes. How do Buddhists view, or traditional ones, creation or the creation of the planet? I mean, maybe Western Buddhists with, you know, since the 19th century and
we've got
Darwin
the advantages of science,
you know, things
so,
like
yeah.
that.
Yes.
But how did the traditional or some schools of traditional Buddhists view what happens in, what was the act of creation or how did it happen? Was there a tradition about
well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, it starts to look at this issue of the connection between religion and belief, doesn't it? So it may be with some religions, you'll have a particular list of beliefs, some of which, unfortunately, may turn out to be disproved, or have to, at least have to be explained in a metaphorical way. You don't actually have that particularly in Buddhism, and the Buddha discouraged people from speculating about origins, in particular, for example. Mm-hmm. So he says, you go back as far as you can. If there's consciousness there, then there's something that gave rise to that consciousness. So in a way, there's always a before. Wherever you go to, there's a before. In a way, very very much evolutionary.
Yeah.
So everything has evolved. It's evolved from precursors in law-governed ways. Mm. There are myths about the cyclic processes in the universe, a huge sort of explosion that then seems to contract again. is known as the fire mist in Tibetan Buddhism. But, you know, these are just myths.
How do you see a sangha being built, for example, in the case of this particular community? I come here on a more regular basis, for example, but every time I come, it's very much a different
group of people, isn't it? Yeah.
I talk to one or two, but
yes.
How does a point come when I actually feel that I'm part of a sangha, apart from the fact that we meditate together?
I think probably for most people it means sometimes, at least meeting some people, not just here. In a way, maybe inviting a few people that you like, that you've met a few times, round to your own home for a meal or something like that. Flapjacks. Flapjacks is the secret, really. So, but you know, I think it does. I think it's, in a way, to some extent, you know, it may be like going to an evening class where it's a completely separate part of your life. And you're very friendly with the people there and you like meeting them. But in a way, they're not a part of your life. I think it becomes sangha when at least some of the people that you meet at the Buddhist centre are also your friends. And you can't make that happen. And nobody can make you make it happen either. It's entirely up to you, obviously. And maybe you don't like anybody, so it's not going to happen. But I think that's how sangha is made, when you get genuine friendships, genuine links and connections between people.
Can I say something?
Yes.
Because I think actually practicing together does create some kind of connection on a deeper level, and that is another aspect of sangha. I know that Paramahansa is very keen on, you know, what happens when you get a group of people just meditating together and what that creates. And I think if you keep on practicing with other people, then there is a sense of something. Particularly as over time, if you do start seeing the same people coming.
Yes, yes, I agree. Yes. Any other thoughts?
I quite like the ebb and flow of our sangha.
Yes.
New faces appear and old faces disappear for some time, then come back.
They come back again.
And
it's always lovely if you see
lovely.
Something you haven't seen for a while.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. And there's some extraordinary things about it as well. It's like sometimes you do find yourself getting to know people you would never in a million years have got to know just through the pub or your work or that kind of thing, where you may be with, you know, in a way you're being quite selective about the type of person you're with. Yeah, are they actually Arsenal supporters, for example? You know, but then you discover you meet a Chelsea supporter at the centre, and at first it's appalling, the whole idea. And then actually you think, no, it's all right, they are human beings, you know. They may be going for, they may be making certain mistakes in their football allegiances, but in other respects, they're all right. Or, you know, wealthy, highly educated people meeting uneducated people, older and younger, different generations, and so on. It's really nice in that way. Difficult at times, you know, because you realize you don't necessarily naturally get on with each other. But it's very, very helpful, I think, to sort of learn to get on with people who are very different from yourself. So shall we leave it there? Is there any last thoughts? So thank you very much for coming along. And next week we have Vilasamani. I don't know if you've started thinking about it. Do you want to say anything about...
I haven't started to think about it.
But Vilasamani will come from somewhere else again. on the basis of that same question. And then the week after we have Bodhilila, and the week after that we have Yashobodhi.
Thank you very much.